Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, December 14th. Today's mini editorial is written by Jolaine Noreen of Sioux City, and she writes, "As I watch the hills around Cone Park being torn up for the bike trails, it makes me wonder who will have to pick up the tab for all the lawsuits that will be coming with all the accidents that will inevitably happen." Again, this was written by Jolaine Noreen of Sioux City. Now, the five-day forecast for this area, looking ahead until next Monday. Today will be mild with periods of sun with a high of 50 and a low of 34. Friday is going to be mostly cloudy with a high of 45 and a low of 27. Saturday will be going between clouds and sun with a high of 42 and a low of 25. Sunday will be mostly sunny and it will be mild with a high of 48 and a low of 19. And then Monday is going to be colder with a high of 38 and a low of 26. Our first story is concerning Representative Randy Feenstra, and the headline is "Power Broker: Feenstra Looms as a Force in 2024 Iowa Caucuses." And this article was written by Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal. All of this is new to Randy Feenstra. Though the 54-year-old Hull, Iowa native is in his second term in the United States House of Representatives, the 2024 Iowa Republican presidential caucuses are the first he has navigated as a congressman. The lack of familiarity has not been an impediment to Feenstra bringing candidates in. Over the past year, he has played host or appeared at campaign stops with GOP candidates Ryan Binkley, Ron DeSantis, Nikki Haley, and Vivek Ramaswamy. Those four attended a Faith and Family with the Feenstras event December 9th at the B.J. Hahn Auditorium on the Dort University campus in Sioux Center. Feenstra and his wife Lynette spent 30 minutes with each one of them and took turns asking questions about their respective faiths and families, as well as a number of issues of the day. DeSantis, who's trailing former President Donald Trump, and his wife Casey seemed especially comfortable with the Feenstras, trading jokes about raising kids. "I think people enjoyed that," Feenstra said, "just hearing the passions and different topics that might give them the ability to say, hey, that is my candidate that I want to support." The district Feenstra represents, Iowa's 4th Congressional District, is by far the most Republican-leaning in the state. University of Northern Iowa political science professor Christopher Larimer says, "Congressman Feenstra is in a district that leans overwhelmingly Republican, so it's not surprising they're going to go to events in his district." The Cook Partisan Voting Index, which breaks down how Democratic or Republican a district gives the 4th District a score of R plus 16 for 2023. Iowa's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Cedar Rapids and Dubuque, was R plus 4 in 2023. The 1st District, Davenport and Iowa City, was an R plus 3 for 2023, as was the 3rd District, which includes Des Moines and Ottumwa. The ranks are based on how many points in either direction a district's voting habits differ from the national popular vote. When Feenstra won in 2020, he defeated now Iowa District 1 Representative J.D. Shulton by 24.2 points. The 2022 margin against Nevada Iowa insurance manager Ryan Melton was even larger, 36.9 points, as Feenstra took 35 of 36 counties in the reconfigured district. Carrying the district has proven key for winning the state in the Republican caucuses. In the 2012 cycle, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum took 34 counties in the 4th on his way to a photo finish with the eventual Republican nominee Mitt Romney. When Texas Senator Ted Cruz won the Iowa GOP caucuses in 2016, he carried 24 of the district's then 39 counties. Prior to the caucus on February 1, 2016, Steve King, who served in Congress for 18 years, 8 as the representative of the 4th District, endorsed Cruz over Trump, who went on to secure the nomination. Bradley Best, a professor of political science at Buena Vista University in Storm Lake, has followed King's congressional career. He said the endorsement led people to wonder if King's move was a decisive factor in securing Iowa for Cruz. "My sense is that King's endorsement had little impact on Cruz's win," Best suggested. "Rather, King publicly aligned himself with Cruz because of the social conservatism they share, the fact that Cruz was positioned for a win in Iowa generally, and Representative King's desire to sustain a connection with his base in the months prior to his own re-election bid." Larimer said the connection between a pre-caucus endorsement and the performance on caucus night, which is January 15, 2024, is difficult to test. "You don't know if someone was already motivated to vote for a candidate," he said. What is clearer, Best and Larimer both said, is the mutual benefit of a presidential campaign event hosted by a member of Congress. Larimer said, "It's exposure for the candidate and elevates the profile of the individual member of Congress. Candidates and elected officials maneuver strategically. So, when they schedule joint appearances, meetups with supporters, or fundraising events, it is because they perceive some mutual advantage in doing so," Best said. At the end of August, Feenstra told reporters at a Tim Scott campaign stop in Sioux Center he planned to endorse in November or the early part of December. November arrived, Scott, a third-term U.S. Senator from South Carolina, dropped out, and no endorsement came from Feenstra. After Faith and Family with the Feenstras Saturday, Feenstra said the pressure to endorse is constant, but not his top priority as his party heads towards the caucuses. He said, "My job, first and forward, is to be the ambassador to anybody who wants to come. Then, whether I'll be endorsing, that will come later. I want everybody to be open-minded. I don't want to dilute their thoughts. I want them to make a decision, and then maybe down the road we will make that decision." Larimer said a noncommittal posture is common for members of the Iowa congressional delegation. "For the most part, it's been not really endorsing, certainly for Senator Grassley and Senator Ernst. Individual members avoid endorsing because they're trying to generate enthusiasm for candidates of a party and enthusiasm for the party. This time could be different, though. The 2024 Iowa caucus cycle has already seen Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds break with nearly 30 years of tradition to announce her support for DeSantis. Prior to the Reynolds announcement, the last time an Iowa governor endorsed before the caucuses was in 1996, when former Governor Terry Branstad backed former Kansas Senator Bob Dole. Branstad came out against Cruz in 2016, but did not publicly support any opponent. However, Feenstra's colleagues have said they're staying out of the endorsement game. Per NBC News, Representatives Ashley Hinson, Marinette Miller-Meeks, and Zach Nuntz all said they plan to stay neutral. According to an endorsement tracker from 538, 175 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives have endorsed a candidate for president, which leaves less than 50 who have yet to weigh in. A lion's share of those endorsements have gone to Trump, who leads DeSantis by 27.1 points in the 538 average of Iowa polls. He leads Haley by 31 points and Ramaswamy by 41.5. Such massive leads have Larimer doubtful about endorsements from the Iowa delegation. "I don't see that at this point," he said, "but it seems like every day is something new." Were Feenstra to endorse, Best thinks there would be an upside for certain candidates. An endorsement from Randy Feenstra in the month or two prior to the caucuses would not be irrelevant. Donald Trump's double-digit lead among Iowa Republicans is not likely to change on the basis of Representative Feenstra's preferences, he said. "To suspect otherwise would require that we believe a representative from Iowa's 4th District is able to impact Trump's appeal to a group of voters whose views seem unaffected by all that appears daily in the headlines about the former president." Trump's appearances in the 4th Congressional District have been rarer than visits from any candidate not named Chris Christie. The former New Jersey governor has opted out of campaigning in Iowa altogether. Since declaring in November 2022, Trump has visited two of the 4th District's largest cities, Council Bluffs and Sioux City, just once each, Neither appearance was hosted by Feenstra. Feenstra, who will celebrate a birthday the day before the caucuses, is not concerned about his place in the campaign. His focus is set on whether the candidates are heard and how Iowa comes across to the White House hopefuls coming in from out of state. I'm just excited to be part of it. And again, it's not about me so much as the candidates coming here and giving their views. I want to put Iowa on the map so whoever becomes president, they know Iowa well and that this isn't the first time coming to Iowa, he said. Our next story, Western Iowa Tech Community College wants to depose alleged human trafficking victims. Western Iowa Tech Community College, facing two multi-million dollar lawsuits alleging it engaged in human trafficking, is arguing the alleged victims must return to Iowa from Chile to sit for depositions in the case. The former students say they cannot afford the expense of returning to Iowa and have sought the court's permission to provide deposition testimony remotely through Zoom-type video conferencing. The two lawsuits against Western Iowa Tech were filed in federal court more than 3 years ago and are scheduled for trial next spring. One lawsuit was filed on behalf of 14 students from Chile, and the other was filed on behalf of 11 other students who mostly originate from Brazil. The lawsuits allege the school enticed impoverished students to come to Iowa, where they were placed in debt bondage, working at a food processing plant and a dog food factory. The Sioux City College allegedly procured visas for the students to enroll in the school's international education program, then steered them to work in the processing plants. The college then diverted money from the students' paychecks to reimburse the school for the cost of the program, the lawsuit claims. As part of recent court filings, lawyers for the school note that the plaintiffs are claiming extraordinarily high damages, damages in the seven-figure range for each plaintiff in this matter. The defendants in the two cases, all of whom have denied any wrongdoing, include the college, several of its employees, Turpak Foods, which runs a food processing plant in Sioux City, Royal Canin USA, which runs a dog food factory in North Sioux City, and J&L Staffing and Recruiting, which allegedly helped place the students in the two plants at the behest of the school. As with most civil lawsuits, parties on both sides of the two cases have scheduled depositions for witnesses to provide sworn testimony prior to any courtroom trial. However, at least seven of the plaintiffs in the case involving the Chilean students have argued that they should be allowed to give their depositions remotely without returning to Iowa. Of the seven, three are living now in Chile and four are living in Florida. One former Witt Community College student, Claudio Ramos of Santiago, Chile, told the court the 5,000-mile flight to Des Moines would take 18 to 24 hours. I cannot afford the expense of an international flight plus hotel rooms, he said in a sworn statement. I am currently employed as a security guard. I make approximately 46,000 Chilean pesos a month, which equals $519.80 per month. I have no savings. The flight alone would cost more than 2 months' worth of income. Attorneys for the school say most of the students returned to Iowa earlier in the year to sit for psychological evaluations related to their claims against the school. They say the social media accounts of one former student from Chile shows him visiting Zombie Burger, the Greater Des Moines Botanical Garden, and 801 Chop House in Des Moines. The school's lawyers also say depositions in the case will be complicated and include five different law firms, countless attorneys, an interpreter, a court reporter, and a substantial number of documents drawn from the 100,000 pages of records that have so far been produced. Plaintiffs have made incredibly serious allegations against the defendants, including human trafficking, fraud, breach of contract, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and violations of Iowa's wage payment collection law, attorneys for the school argue. Based on the uncommon and egregious nature of plaintiff's claims alone, plaintiffs should be required to appear in person for their depositions. Lawyers for the Chilean students say some of their clients are currently unemployed, lack a valid passport, or have yet to obtain the necessary visa to return to Iowa and sit for depositions. They also claim that the defendants themselves are responsible for at least some of the limitations on travel that the students now face. For example, one program that allows for quick approval of travel abroad screens out Chileans who may have violated immigration laws by working in unauthorized jobs. That could restrict the travel of former students who were trafficked into jobs that they were not legally authorized to perform, the plaintiff's attorneys allege. The two sides recently reached an agreement to have the former students now living in Florida come to Iowa and complete their depositions in a 12-hour session structured to minimize their travel expenses. As for the former students now in Chile, it remains uncertain as to whether they'll be granted permission to enter the United States. Their depositions have been delayed to January to give the parties more time to negotiate a resolution. Currently, the two civil cases are expected to go to trial between April and June of 2024. Each of the defendants has denied wrongdoing, and the school has stated that any damages the students suffered were caused by or contributed by their own actions. The first of the lawsuits was filed in late 2020 and has survived a broad array of legal challenges mounted by the defendants. Chief Judge of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Iowa, Leonard T. Strand, dismissed claims of racketeering and indentured servitude against the defendants in one case, but let stand several counts alleging human trafficking, breach of contract, fraud, and with regard to the school, the intentional infliction of emotional distress. Whit Community College specifically prohibited the students from seeking other employment without permission, making their labor for Turpac or Royal Canin the only way they could provide for themselves, Strand stated in his ruling. The students are foreign nationals with varying levels of proficiency in English. They all made financial sacrifices to be part of the program, with several of them selling nearly everything they owned prior to enrolling in the program. The lawsuits allege that Witt Community College recruited the students with the promise of an education as well as work in the culinary arts or robotics industries. However, the culinary arts program students signed up for was allegedly rebranded as a food service diploma program, and the robotics program students signed up for was rebranded as an electromechanical technician program. After arriving in Iowa, the students were put to work on meatpacking production lines to help fill a labor shortage in western Iowa. Some of the students had to work 12-hour overnight shifts and then report to class by 8 a.m., one of the lawsuits alleges. The school allegedly arranged for J&L to put the students to work at Turpac and Royal Canin. The arrangement allegedly called for the two companies to pay $15 an hour for the students' labor, with $7.75 an hour of that routed to the college to offset the expense of the students' housing, tuition, and fees. No criminal charges have been filed in the case. Our next story is headlined Governor Reynolds, Iowa's Area Education Agencies Need to Change. Changes may be coming to Iowa's area education agencies that provide expertise to educators and families as Governor Kim Reynolds and legislative leaders say changes must be made to improve the educational outcomes of students with disabilities. National and state data shows Iowa students with disabilities have significant proficiency gaps. While the AEAs will continue to serve students with disabilities, changes are necessary to improve student outcomes, Reynolds said in a statement. A comprehensive review of AEAs will help identify solutions. Parents can be assured that their children will continue to receive the services they need. In an earlier statement to the Northwest Iowa Review, which the governor's office provided to the Gazette, Reynolds said AEAs have significantly expanded their scope of services beyond the core mission, and said data shows significant performance gaps among students with disabilities despite the Iowa agency spending more per pupil than the national average. Iowa educators, however, worry about what this means for the future of the agencies after decades of diminished funding from the state. Today, there are 9 AEAs across the state, and services from them are available from birth to age 21. John Spear, chief administrator of Grantwood AEA, there's been a steady drumbeat of Iowa lawmakers interested in education, so it does not surprise us that the AEA system would be part of that discussion. If changes are to be made to the agency, Spear said, he hopes they are not made quickly without due diligence. Grantwood AEA serves 74,000 students in public and accredited non-public schools in seven counties in eastern Iowa, including Lynn and Johnson, and employs about 500 staff. This includes speech pathologists and occupational therapists. About 70% of the funding for Iowa's AEAs goes to support special education services, but the agencies also were created to meet school needs in better media and technology and educational services, including math, science, and literacy. By law, AEAs can spend no more than 5% of their budget on administrative costs. Each AEA in Iowa is below that threshold, Spear said. Cindy Yellick, chief administrator of the Heartland AEA, which serves more than 80 public and accredited non-public schools in central Iowa, said if decisions are being made about the future of AEAs, she hopes that there are people at the table who deeply understand our services and are consumers of our services, like public school administrators and parents. Further decreasing the agency's budgets would be an educational malpractice and an enormous disservice to school districts across the state, said Greg Battenhorst, superintendent of the Mount Vernon Community School District. Some of the AEA staff who work with Mount Vernon teachers and families feel like our own, Battenhorst said. I consider them full members of our team. State Senator Ken Rosenboom, a Republican from Pella and chair of the Senate Education Committee, said he has not seen specifics from the governor's office. Rosenboom, though, said he agrees with the governor's statement that AEAs have expanded their scope of services and have become too top-heavy. The function of AEAs was and is primarily helping with special needs children in schools, and the governor has a strong passion for supporting special education service, Rosenboom said. Recent Iowa test results show proficiency gaps for students with disabilities compared with overall student results. Those with disabilities scored between 33 to 50% percentage points lower on the statewide math tests than the overall student population. Rosenboom said academic proficiency scores in math and reading for students with disabilities have declined over the last 20 years, and that Iowa students with disabilities also perform below the national average and surrounding states. My perception is that AEAs are administratively heavy and performance light, he said. We need to refocus and direct our efforts to providing education needs for the education of special needs children, which is extremely important. Rosenboom said concerns about possibly cutting or closing AEAs are speculative and not accurate. House Education Committee Chair Skylar Wheeler, Republican from Hull, and Education Appropriations Subcommittee Chair Carter Norden, a Republican from Pandora, said in a joint statement they are supportive of a comprehensive review of our AEAs to ensure that Iowa students with disabilities are receiving the quality education they deserve. The pair said special education students deserve the very best and look forward to learning more about the governor's proposal. State Representative Brent Sechrist, a Republican from Council Bluffs, who served as an executive director of the Iowa Area Education Agency, said AEAs are not afraid of having people look at them and what they do. Certainly, there's room for improvement in any organization, he said. The AEAs serve a vital function, particularly for the vast majority of our rural schools. It has to be looked at very careful because it could have a big impact on rural Iowa and the services provided. Sechrist noted Iowa's AEAs have consolidated over time, merging from 15 to 9, and have sustained budget cuts that leaders said are eroding services. Iowa's nine agencies saw a nearly $30 million decrease for the fiscal year from legislative cuts. Lawmakers passed Senate File 578, which included a $7.5 million annual cut required by law, as well as an additional $22 million reduction agreed on by Republican lawmakers. That is $5 million more than what lawmakers cut to the agencies last year, according to a fiscal analysis by the Nonpartisan Legislative Services. Rosenboom disputed the notion that Iowa's AEAs are underfunded. We have reduced the statutory budget, and no one has ever complained about that because everyone knew it was administratively heavy, he said. The Grantwood AEA offers an example of the services to schools and parents the agencies provide. The services include virtual ongoing license renewal courses, allowing educators to access continuing education hours required to renew their license every 5 years. Consultants who work with school counselors to meet with the social and emotional needs of students and help them plan for life after high school. English language learner consultants on staff who help district teachers support students who are non-native English language speakers. Autism consultants who teach districts how to create a program that increases opportunities for students with social skills deficits. Learning tools like virtual welding simulators that schools can borrow for their students to explore different career interests, and computer science training and resources now that schools are required by the state to provide computer science instruction. Grantwood AEA also facilitates grant-funded programs like the Child Alliance Response Team, which provides coaching and consultation of behavior intervention strategies to child care providers to support children ages 5 and younger. The program was funded by Early Childhood Iowa, a statewide initiative. Jessica Bartlett, a special education teacher at Washington Elementary School in the Mount Vernon Community School District, said she teaches students with a wide range of disabilities and needs. It's impossible for us to be experts in everything, said Bartlett, who has taught special education for 23 years. She said it would be scary to do what she does without the support of the AEA staff. Bartlett also has worked with agency staff as a mother. When her son was born prematurely 11 years ago, an audiologist from AEA supported the family. Today, her son's hearing is just fine. He never stops talking, she said with a laugh. Cedar Rapids School Superintendent Tawana Grover said the AEA was a critical partner in their search for a new special education director early this year. It's very valuable when you have an organization ready to be adaptable to the needs of a school district, Grover said. Nature Center to recycle trees after Christmas. The Woodbury County Conservation Board will be collecting undecorated Christmas trees from December 26 to January 17 at the Dorothy Pico Nature Center at 4500 Sioux River Road. Trees should be clean with no ornaments, tinsel, lights, price tag stands, or plastic bags, and may be placed in the Nature Center's parking lot. The nature trail contains 2 miles of hiking trails. The trees will be chipped and placed on the trails to provide a better walking surface to prevent erosion. We'll now move to a weekly column written by Kathy Yoder, and the headline on that is At Home for Christmas This Year. If you have ever been away from home on Christmas, you know how lonely that can be. Maybe you become stranded in bad weather. It's unsafe to travel on snow and ice-packed roads, so you pull off the road and manage to get the last room in an out-of-the-way motel. Or you have started a new job and cannot spend Christmas with family because you have no vacation time. Maybe you've had a falling out with those you've always been with for Christmas. You'd like to reconcile, but it's hard to take that first step asking for forgiveness. At times, it's even harder to forgive. No one makes a move, so the hurt and the pain of separation grows wider. Maybe there's a death in the family. No matter where you go, you feel sad, and your home doesn't feel like home without your loved one. You may wonder, will you ever feel like home again? Think about Joseph and Mary. Mary's young when the angel Gabriel appears to her. He says, "Greetings, favored woman. The Lord is with you." This is from Luke 1:28. Confused and disturbed, Mary tries to think what the angel could mean. "Don't be afraid," the angel told her, "for you have found favor with God. You will conceive and give birth to a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be very great and will be called the Son Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of ancestor David, and he will reign over Israel forever. His kingdom will never end." From Luke 1:29-33. Mary is engaged to Joseph. Life is all planned out and very predictable until it isn't. Mary receives the crazy news that she's going to give birth to the Son of God. Yes, it's a privilege and indescribable honor, and yet she's a young woman who will soon be showing the signs that she's pregnant. People will gossip. It's a fact. What will they say? Mary has no idea how Joseph will react to this news. He might leave her. If he does, she'll likely never marry. Mary's own father may feel disgraced and turn her away, choosing not to believe this wild story about a virgin birth told by an angel. Mary could become homeless. She could fret, worry, and come up with her own plan, ignoring everything that Gabriel tells her. She could walk away from this request. She doesn't. Instead, she simply trusts her God. Mary knows that he makes everything work out in his timing. Her own words to Gabriel reflect her true character. Mary responded, "I am the Lord's servant. May everything that you said about me come true." Then the angel left her, from Luke 1:38. She doesn't worry about her earthly home because she knows the truth. Her home is with God. Joseph doesn't know what to do. He loves Mary, but he can't marry her when she's obviously been with another man. He thinks about quietly divorcing her. He's an honorable man and doesn't want to see her hurt any more than she already will be. In the custom of the day, it's acceptable to have Mary stoned to death. In a dream, Joseph is told the truth. While he was trying to figure a way out, he had a dream. Joseph, son of David, don't hesitate to get married. Mary's pregnancy is spirit conceived. God's Holy Spirit has made her pregnant. She will bring a son to birth, and when she does, you, Joseph, will name him Jesus. God saves, because he will save his people from their sins. From Matthew 1:20-21. What a powerful dream. Joseph knows it comes from God. He obeys and takes Mary as his wife. Mary and Joseph travel away from home to Bethlehem to be counted in the census. Mary is at home with the news that her time has come. She's going to give birth in Bethlehem. She's at home in the stable where she gives birth to Jesus among animals with a bright star shining on them. Joseph is at home with the news that this baby is from the Lord because the Lord is his home. He's at home with Mary, his wife. He's at home on the road to be counted in the census. He's at home in the stable with his family. He's at home with his newborn baby he names Jesus. The shepherds are at home with the sheep they watch over. They're at home when an angel suddenly appears and says, "I bring you good news that will bring great joy to all people. The Savior, yes, the Messiah, the Lord, has been born today in Bethlehem, the city of David, and you will recognize him by this sign. You will find a baby wrapped snugly in strips of cloth lying in a manger." And this is from Luke 2:10-12. A vast host of angels joins the first angel, saying, "Glory to God in the highest heaven, and peace on earth to those with whom God is pleased." Luke 2:14. The shepherds travel to the stable. They're at home with the newborn Jesus, even though they've just met him. May it be true for each one of us this Christmas season and every day, that no matter our circumstances in life and no matter where we live, may we all know that when Jesus is our Lord, we are at home with him. Come home for Christmas. And again, this was written by Kathy Yoder, who is a devotional writer. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, December 14th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. We'll now move to today's obituaries. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Jermaine Jerry O'Donnell of Sioux City passed away on Friday, December 8th in Jacksonville, Florida at the age of 83. Services will be on Tuesday, December 19th, with visitation from 9 to 10 a.m., followed with Mass at 10 a.m., both at Nativity Catholic Church with the Reverend Brad Pelzel officiating. Burial will be at 11 a.m. at Memorial Park Cemetery with military rites conducted. A luncheon will follow at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Jermaine Jerry Gergen O'Donnell was born in Granville, Iowa on January 17, 1940 to parents Joseph and Margaret Gergen. She attended St. Joseph's Catholic Grade School and High School in Granville, graduating in 1958. Following graduation, she attended the St. Vincent's Hospital School of Nursing in Sioux City, graduating in 1961. Jerry practiced nursing for 39 years at the former St. Vincent's Hospital and Mercy Medical Center in Sioux City, with the last 22 years of her career in orthopedic and neurosurgery in the operating room. Jerry married Joseph F. O'Donnell on July 27, 1963 in Granville at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Joe died April 13, 2001. Jerry joined the Iowa Air National Guard, the former 185th Tactical Fighter Group in Sioux City, in September 1973 as a first lieutenant and was assigned to the medical squadron. Lieutenant Colonel O'Donnell was the chief nurse in the clinic for the last 15 years of her Air National Guard career. Jerry retired from the Iowa Air National Guard in December 1996 as a lieutenant colonel and received a retirement ride in the F-16, which was piloted by her son Barry, who was a member of the same unit at the time. Lieutenant Colonel O'Donnell was the first female officer to retire from the Sioux City Air National Guard unit. Jerry was a member of Nativity Catholic Church in Sioux City, the Confraternity of Christian Mothers, and an active member of the Ladies Guild and president of St. Vincent's Hospital School of Nursing Alumni Association for many years. Jerry loved being a nurse and always said she could not imagine doing anything else. She so enjoyed preparing scrapbooks and photo albums for her family and for her many grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you consider a donation in her honor to one of her favorite charities, which are Tunnels to Towers, Community Hospice, or St. Jude Children's Hospital. Marilyn B. Lara, 78, of South Sioux City, was delivered into the loving arms of our Lord in December 2023 after a brief illness. A funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 15th, at St. Michael's Catholic Church in South Sioux City. Visitation will begin at the church at 9:30 until the service. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery, Sioux City. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City is handling the arrangements. Marilyn was born on December 3, 1945, to Henry Shorty and Margene Hofelt in Sioux City. Always hardworking, she provided financially for her family's well-being and her children's parochial school educations. She retired in 2004 after 25 years at Aramark as a seamstress. She had also worked at Zenith, Alls Manufacturing, and Levi Strauss in Amarillo, Texas. As a young lady, Marilyn could not wait to start a family and be a mother. Marilyn and former spouse Lawrence Laura had three daughters they loved and raised together, Janice, Tracy, and Marilyn. This union celebrated five beloved grandchildren and five gorgeous great-grandchildren. In her early days, Marilyn enjoyed riding horses, dancing, bowling, softball, and volleyball. Later, she gained enjoyment from activities including golf, traveling, fishing, aqua aerobics, bargain shopping, bingo, and playing board games. She was also a sports fan and loved following her children, grandchildren, and eldest great-granddaughter in sports. With her partner, Jerry Balke, she cheered for New York Yankees, University of Nebraska, and Michigan State athletes, and enjoyed watching PGA golf. Marilyn and Jerry also enjoyed taking casino bus trips, spoiling their dog Rosie, and attending concerts and dinners at the Hard Rock. Marilyn lovingly welcomed Jerry's adult children, Brenda and Brian, into her heart and home. Marilyn had a creative side and made Christmas crafts and decorated cakes. Her creativity extended into making family celebrations special. She put great effort into throwing fun birthday parties for her children, and she spared no effort in preparing family holiday meals. She loved spending time with her daughters and great-grandchildren. Marilyn was always happy and full of laughter at family gatherings and parties. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts and donations may be made to the family. Marilyn will be remembered as a hard worker and for how generously she loved and cared for others, especially in their time of need. She will be celebrated for her enjoyment from activities with family and friends, and she will be greatly missed for her listening ear, beautiful smile, and fun-loving spirit. Diane Lee Donnelly of Elk Point, South Dakota, passed away on Saturday, December 9th, at the age of 79, while surrounded by her children. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 15th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Elk Point, with burial to follow at St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, December 14th, with a wake service at 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements are under the direction of Cobra Funeral Home in Elk Point. Diane was born on August 16, 1944, in Sioux City to Joe and Dolores Koppel. She graduated from Helan High School with the class of 1962. She then married George Donnelly on January 7, 1963. They had three children and farmed in rural Elk Point. She was a member of St. Joseph's Catholic Church, where she was an active member of the Altar Society and a past CCD coordinator. She was a member of the Red Hats, several bridge groups, and was an active member of Sun Valley and Elk Point Country Club. She was known for her kindness and being everyone's caretaker. She enjoyed spending time with family and attending her grandchildren's activities. She will be dearly missed. Ramona A. Christensen, Omaha, Nebraska. Funeral services will be held Saturday, December 16th at West Center Chapel. Memorials are suggested to American Heart Association and American Lung Association. To view a live broadcast of the service, please visit heffyheffy.com and click the live cast button at the top of the homepage. And that's heffyheffy.com. Ronald L. Nielsen, 89, of Sioux City, passed away Sunday, December 10th. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, December 15th, at the Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Burial in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. until service time at the funeral home. Sandra D. Bach, 62, of Sioux City, passed away Saturday, December 9th, at her home, surrounded by the love of her family. Funeral services will be at 12 p.m. December 16th at Waterbury Funeral Services of Sioux City. Visitation will be 2 hours prior to the service at the funeral home. Myron L. Wimmer, 83, of Kingsley, passed away Tuesday, December 12th. There will be no services at this time. A gravesite service will be held at a later date. Road Funeral Home in Kingsley is assisting family with arrangements. Dorothy Ann Daniels, 80, of Ponca, Nebraska, passed away unexpectedly on Monday, December 11th. Memorial services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, December 18th at Salem Lutheran Church in Ponca. Visitation with the family will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, December 17th, with a prayer service at 7 p.m., all at the church. Burial will be at the Salem Lutheran Cemetery in Ponca. Dorothy was born July 29, 1943, in Sioux City, the daughter of Wilbert and Stella Jansen. She graduated from Soldier High School in 1961. Dorothy married Dean Daniels on June 25, 1961, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Ute. To this union, six children were born. Dean preceded Dorothy in death on August 24, 2016, in Ponca. While the children were young, Dorothy stayed home until they were school age. She then worked as a waitress for 15 years and was a cashier at Diamond Horseshoe. In the 70s, she worked at the Carousel Restaurant and witnessed the hottest new craze at the time, streaking. In 1993, Dorothy began working at John Morrell. She retired from CPT Transport in 2015. Dorothy enjoyed music and singing, gardening and sewing, but most of all, she loved spending time with her grandchildren and recently enjoyed going to Storm and Norman's Dance Hall with her good friend Karen. Dorothy was a member of Salem Lutheran Church. Memorial donations may be given to Salem Lutheran Church in Dorothy's memory. And now we'll move to the sports section and do the Sioux City Journal Player of the Year for Large School All-Area Team. Western Christian's Shayna Van Dyken. Shayna Van Dyken saved her best performances in a Western Christian High School volleyball uniform for the biggest stage. On the Wolfpack's march to a Class 3A state championship to close the 2023 season, Van Dyken went for 51 kills over the three matches at the state tournament. Western Christian head coach Tammy Verbeek said, "We really needed her to have a breakout season for us to be successful. We knew she had a really big swing, really fast arm speed, so we really needed her to finish points for us." And She just continued to grow for us throughout the season and had a really big state tournament. Van Dyken ended the season with 407 kills for the season, which put her in the top five in Class 3A. Her average of 3.5 kills per set was 15th in 3A. Her performance not only helped deliver Western Christian its 19th state volleyball title, but seemingly opened up a whole new future for the senior, who's the Journal's Large School All-Area Player of the Year. "I'm excited to see what the future may bring," she said. "I decided this year that I wanted to play somewhere in college after realizing how much I loved it. I just don't want to give it up yet." The patience was a virtue for Van Dyken, who went into her senior season with the Wolfpack with 103 career kills at the varsity level between her sophomore and junior seasons. "I started playing around fourth or fifth grade," Van Dyken said. "I've always loved it. In middle school, I realized it was something that I wanted to do all the time and really fell in love with it." When her time came at state and Western Christian needed its biggest swings, the Wolfpack turned to Van Dyken over and over again. And she delivered. For her efforts, Van Dyken was named first team All-State in Class 3A by the IGCA and took home the Top Producer Award as part of being named to the 3A All-State Tournament team. She also ended the season with an even 100 digs and 40 blocks to go with a kill efficiency of 239. As a sophomore, she only saw the court at the varsity level for one match. As a junior, she dutifully fulfilled her role as more of a secondary attacker for the Wolfpack, who won the Class 2A state title in 2022. And as a senior, she flourished. Verbeck said, who's also Van Dyken's aunt, "She was kind of a role player for us as a junior. We had a big senior class ahead of her, and we've had a lot of family come through the program, but it was really neat to see her have the big year that she did. She really stepped up, and it was a lot of fun to see her rise to the occasion." Emblematic of Van Dyken's career path, Western Christian traveled a bit of a bumpy road to get to the top in 2023. "We had a loss to Cherokee where we were like, wow, we need to figure this out," said Van Dyken. "We were losing to teams that we didn't think we should be losing to, and we would sit in the locker room and cry." Not tied to a conference, the Wolfpack played the top competition around multiple states. Western Christian started the season on a three-game win streak at the Sheldon Early Bird Tournament, then tackling one more win at the Bellevue West Nebraska Invitational before it ended the season to the tournament on a four-game skid to start the season in unfamiliar territory at 500 through eight games. "We had a lot of ups and downs," Van Dyken said. The Wolfpack then rattled off 10 wins in 11 tries and went on to finish 32-12 in the end in possession of the gold trophy. "Western Christian has been blessed," Verbeek said. "This was our 23rd straight year at state. So a lot of these girls grew up watching the teams before them, and it's all they've ever really known. They'd come to just watch the team or watch their siblings or cousins play. There's so much generational talent here, they're not content unless they win." After one match at state, the girls came up to me and said, "The team that lost wasn't even crying, coach. It was just boggling to them that there were teams just content to be at state." As it turned out, the Wolfpack's best competition to turn around their season came from within their own locker room. "We decided that we really needed to push each other to be our best," Van Dyken said. "It was an eye-opener. After that, after the Cherokee loss, we really turned the page. Playing at a school that has such a strong program, you feel a little bit of pressure in that, especially after winning a state title in 2022 and losing seven seniors." It all made Western Christian one of, if not the most, battle-tested teams to end the season at the Extreme Arena in Coralville. "Even though there were a lot of frustration in losing, we had to realize that some good was coming out of it. It was making us better and more hungry to win," Van Dyken said. "We would go back to practice the next day and realize that it was better for us to lose to really good teams at that point than beating bad teams." Like Van Dyken, the Wolfpack just needed to wait their turn to shine when the biggest lights were on them, and shine they did. "The whole experience was a lot of fun," Van Dyken said. "I already miss it. I wish I could go back and relive it all over again." Still, through all the winning the Wolfpack did, it's the little things that might stick in Van Dyken's head the longest from her time at Western Christian. "Our team was very close," she said. "Going on the road trips and the team camps were always fun. The team camps especially, when we got to stay overnight and go out to eat together. That's when we really became a family. I will definitely cherish those moments." We'll now move to Dear Abby. In our first letter, "Dear Abby, after decades of research, I'm thrilled with the recent major progress being made in treatments for people who already have symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. I am hoping that one day we will be able to prevent people from developing memory impairment and dementia. Brain changes, including the buildup of a toxic protein into amyloid plaques, begin up to 20 years before a person notices any symptoms. The asymptomatic stage may be the perfect time to test treatments, aiming to delay or prevent symptoms before they begin. This is why we are conducting the AHEAD study, an investigational trial of lecanemab, a FDA-approved medication for mild cognitive impairment and mild dementia due to Alzheimer's. The AHEAD study is testing whether starting lecanemab in those with amyloid plaques before symptoms start can prevent cognitive decline. As a neurologist, a clinical researcher, and someone who has seen Alzheimer's in my own family, I'm grateful we're seeing such progress in our field. But Abby, we need help from your readers to test these promising medications before the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease are apparent. Those interested in the AHEAD study should call 800-243-2370 to help us get ahead of Alzheimer's. And this is signed by Reza Sperling, MD, Professor of Neurology at Harvard Medical School. And Abby responds, "Thank you for your letter. Readers, more than 6 million Americans have Alzheimer's. Changing the trajectory of the disease before symptoms appear is an important scientific pursuit. Clinical trials hold the key to new and better Alzheimer's disease treatments. Approximately 55,000 volunteers are needed for more than 180 clinical trials. In addition to the AHEAD study, the Alzheimer's Association offers TrialMatch, a free service that connects people living with dementia, caregivers, and healthy volunteers to clinical trials. Clinical trial volunteers are key to better treatments, preventive strategies, and a cure for Alzheimer's disease. Visit trialmatch.alz.org or call 800-272-3900 to learn more." Then our next letter. "Dear Abby, my daughter is married with two kids. They live a few hours away. I love seeing them, but I have just one issue. She constantly corrects the way I pronounce words. No one ever mentioned it before she did. A lot of the pronunciations are how my family members and people in my state pronounce them. She started criticizing me after she lived in three different states. Has reached a point where I dread seeing her. I feel self-conscious and my self-esteem gets shot down every time I do. When I tell her it hurts me, she says I'm being too sensitive. I don't know what I should do. Signed, hurting over this." And Abby responds, "People who make comments that hurt other people's feelings and then tell them they are too sensitive are rude and passive-aggressive. What you should do is tell your arrogant daughter to knock it off because you have had it." And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, December 14th. I am your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.